This is Sarah Merck. I'm in the Walgreens on the corner of 33rd and Killingsworth in Northeast Portland, and I'm looking for Plan B One Step, which is supposed to be available over the counter. And I'm in the aisle that has lots of condoms and lube and Vagisil, and somewhere around here should be Plan B. Oh, there it is. It's right there. It's on the top of the aisle. It's in a purple box. Plan B One Step Emergency Contraception. $51.99. You can just take the box to the counter. That was easy.
There was a time when reproductive health choices meant Roe v. Wade. But things have changed. Now the struggle over a woman's right to choose has moved outside the confines of the Supreme Court and into pharmacies, state legislatures, city councils, and even medical schools.
When I told him that I planned on pursuing training in obstetrics and gynecology, he scoffed at me, used words like murder, and this was in the operating room with nurses listening and other residents listening.
After losing ground at the national level, abortion opponents have shifted to a local focus. Local institutions can create restrictions that prevent women from getting abortions or emergency contraception, even if the law is on their side. I'm Andrew Stelzer, your host this week on Making Contact. We'll be going from Albuquerque to New York City later in the show. But first, let's go back to Bitch Magazine's Sarah Merck, who we just heard a moment ago taking a trip to her local drugstore.
My visit to Walgreens in Portland, Oregon, was how getting Plan B is supposed to go. In June 2013, the Food and Drug Administration approved the brand name emergency contraceptive to be stocked on pharmacy shelves across the country for women of all ages. No prescription needed, no asking someone to get it from behind the counter, no age limits. Just grab it like some aspirin and be on your way. But for many Native women, getting emergency contraception isn't always as easy as walking into a Walgreens. Here's a not-so-unusual story from Micah Butsini. She was raised on a Navajo reservation in Arizona and now lives in New Mexico.
Well, I had my first child in 2009, and after having baby, they ask you, do you want to get on birth control? And if you don't want a baby right after, you're going to get on birth control. So I got on birth control. I was a new mom, forgot pills, and, you know, for I think maybe a week, I had forgotten to take my day-to-day pills. So I went into the Endon Health Hospital and asked for emergency contraceptive, and I learned that they do not offer it over the counter, so I had to go see a doctor. And so when I went in to see the doctor, I was treated like I wasn't supposed to be using emergency contraceptive at all. You know, I was told, you need to use condoms, you need to take your birth control. It shows on our chart that we issue you birth control. Why aren't you taking it? And on top of that, when I had initially called, I was told, well, we don't have any walk-in appointments. You'll have to come back tomorrow. So that 24-hour period was already gone. And as you know, emergency contraceptive is most effective the sooner you take it.
Butsini also worked as a community health worker and realized her own experience was similar to what many of her clients were facing.
So then I started to do my own research. I decided, well, where best to start than to call my own, the clinic in where I'm from in Monument Valley. I have nieces who have friends who are sexually active and don't access birth control because they don't want their parents to find out. So I called over to the clinic and I asked them, I want to know if I can get the emergency contraceptive pill. And I was asked, who is this? You know, what do you need? What do you need this for? Who are your parents? May I ask who's calling? And I said, no, I don't want anybody to know. I'm just asking, can I access it there? And they, you know, again, who is this? And I said, do you need my name? And he's like, yes. And I was like, okay, well, when I come into the clinic, I will give you my name. Well, who is this? Who are your parents? You know? And so then I just started to realize, whoa, this is a really huge barrier to get access to this Plan B when it shouldn't be.
Oh, This is the Dancing in the Square Powwow, an annual Native American gathering put on by the Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board. It's a celebration that brings together local tribes, but it's also a chance to raise awareness about important issues facing Indians living in Oregon and connect them to healthcare resources.
People don't know the difference between emergency contraception and medical abortion, and there's a lot of non-education around the subject.
That misunderstanding is the first problem, says Jessica Leston. She's the clinical programs manager at the Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board, the group that helps put on the powwow. Plan B and other types of emergency contraception actually prevent pregnancy from happening if taken within 3 to 5 days of unprotected sex. They do that by delaying or disrupting ovulation, which means they've helped millions of women avoid accidental pregnancies. In Native American communities, access to Plan B is crucial, says Sharon Esatoya, executive director of the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center based in South Dakota.
There is an extremely high rate of sexual assaults that occur on reservations in this country. One in three Native women will be sexually assaulted at least once in her life. And it's important that women know that these services are available. I've always said that emergency contraceptives help to reduce the residual effects of sexual assault, one being unwanted or unplanned pregnancy from a sexual assault.
But despite that need, access to emergency contraception lags in Native communities. Native Americans receive free health care through the Indian Health Services, IHS, a federal agency that runs clinics all over the country. And although federally managed facilities must follow FDA regulations, the reality doesn't always live up to the law. While the FDA ruled in 2009 that Plan B should be available over-the-counter to women over age 17, Indian Health Services did not work that change into its policies until this year, under pressure from Native women and the ACLU. However, they have still not caught up to the recent all-ages ruling, and meanwhile, Indian health centers managed independently by tribes have the authority to decide what products they carry. All of this means that Native women have unequal access to emergency contraception. Whether or not they can easily get the legal drug depends in part on where they live.
Every other woman in this country, every other race of women in this country had access to emergency contraceptive as an OTC, except for Native women within our healthcare system.
Research conducted by Esatoya and others found that many Indian Health Services pharmacies did not carry any emergency contraception, nor did they offer it over the counter. A 2012 survey from the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center found that 43% of clinics serving Native American women did not carry any emergency contraception at all. Only 11% of pharmacies surveyed carried emergency contraception over the counter. IHS wouldn't comment on tape for this story, but in a written statement said that Plan B is currently available at all federally run facilities from the pharmacy window for women 17 and older, and will be for all ages once FDA labels on the packaging have changed. They noted that a verbal directive has been issued to all IHS pharmacies, but advocates for access say an official policy needs to be put on paper, as a verbal directive can easily be changed, and tribal-run facilities need to evolve as well. Traveling to an off-reservation pharmacy means coming up with transportation, gas money, and having to pay for emergency contraception, whereas it's free at IHS clinics, if they carry it.
We feel like this is step one to make sure that, you know, the women are, their human rights are just as equal as other women who have the access to go to the pharmacy and buy it for $50.
Pam Kingfisher, who lives within the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma, has been one of the leaders of the campaign for access to emergency contraception. She says it's taking time, but things are changing.
We've gotten the IHS to roll over and start providing it. When we went before the National Congress of American Indians last year and got a resolution of support from them, it was like black and white from 6 or 7 years ago where you didn't, women's issues were not talked about from the podium.
While Kingfisher, Esatoya, and others keep up the pressure on the bureaucracy, they're also working to educate women about contraception on a grassroots level by creating thousands of small informational cards that can be distributed at clinics, community centers, and between friends. The most important thing, say advocates, is educating women themselves about Plan B, how it works, and where they can get it. For Making Contact, I'm Sarah Merck with Bitch Magazine in Portland, Oregon.
So, say you are able to get Plan B or other emergency contraception, but it doesn't work. Women should be able to decide what to do next, at least according to the Supreme Court decision in Roe v. Wade 4 decades ago. But these days, much of the debate about abortion takes place far from Washington, D.C., in state capitals. And in the city of Albuquerque, the struggle has been getting even more local. This November, city voters will be faced with a ballot measure banning abortion after 20 weeks of pregnancy. Supporters and opponents have descended on the town, which some have dubbed the late-term abortion capital of the country. In a special joint project, Making Contact and the Santa Fe Reporter have been following the intense campaign on both sides of the issue. Carrie Young has the story.
Hi, how are you? God bless you. Come over here for a minute. Yeah, we're the good guys. I'm going to give you this.
On the sidewalk in front of the clinic Southwest Women's Options, a group of abortion opponents are pacing, holding signs, and doing their best to intercept anyone going inside. Lorenzo Espinoza and the 5 other volunteers here today are from a local group called Project Defending Life.
If we're out here every day, you know, one or two people out of maybe 10 or 15 or 20 will take the literature.
In many American cities, scenes like this happen all the time outside of abortion clinics. But today, these pro-lifers aren't the only ones patrolling the sidewalks. This week, a group of pro-choice organizations is sending out their own team of legal observers.
Hey, Brooke, it's Joan. So once they left UNM, did they go downtown? Have they gone to any of the clinics? Okay. All right. We'll see you about 5 o'clock.
Joan Sanford is with the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice, one of the groups organizing the observer effort.
So our volunteers are going out in teams, and they will just monitor and watch and record anything that just doesn't seem safe. And our priority is for the patients and the clinic staff, the doctors, nurses, other counselors.
Basically, they're making sure the protesters follow city laws, and if they don't, they call in the authorities.
We have young women, we have older women, we have men volunteering, and they're just so committed to justice for women and for families, and they just said, you know, not in my town, this is not going to happen. I want my friends, my family, and people we love to make sure they can get the health care that they need.
But their presence wasn't exactly welcomed by the pro-life group at Southwest Women's Options.
So these are the people that are from out of state. Are you from Colorado, ma'am? And they don't talk. It's an intimidation. It's a type of intimidation when somebody is sticking out their camera and watching you. They're here trying to catch us and doing something evil or wrong on the sidewalk. When the real issue is right inside there. So we're not going to murder any children. We're not going to hurt any women.
Tensions are especially high this week, with accusations on both sides that their ideological opponents are bringing in out-of-staters to boost their numbers. The reason is that 3 major anti-abortion groups are hosting an activist training camp here, and together they've turned Albuquerque into an abortion battleground of sorts.
How do y'all feel about late-term abortion? It's legal up to 9 months in Albuquerque.
Yeah, it shouldn't be. Yeah.
9 months, Albuquerque.
Throughout the week, activists from the training camp staged protests in locations across the city. Monday morning brought them to the University of New Mexico, and Lauren Handy is doing her best to hand out an informational pamphlet to pedestrians near a busy crosswalk.
We actually had someone change their mind, even up to first trimester. And this is why we're out here, change hearts and minds.
Then there's Eric DeLau. He's one of about 15 people holding signs that say, "Do you know? Do you care?" next to a picture of what he says is an aborted fetus.
Do you think it's okay to kill babies, you know, U.S. citizens, with scissors through their necks and things like that? It's just not right.
DeLau adds that while his group is against abortion altogether, this week they're specifically focusing on abortions after 20 weeks, or so-called late-term abortions.
People claim to be pro-choice, but they don't really know what that choice means. People here need to know the truth of what's going on. Then they should have an opinion. Then they should be able to vote. They need to be informed. So we're here to provide that information for them.
The key word here being vote, because these protesters aren't just trying to change the hearts and minds of those considering abortions like in most cities. They're also trying to sway public opinion. A new ballot initiative called the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Ordinance will ask Albuquerque voters to decide whether abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy should stay legal in the city.
We were thinking, well, what can we do here in the late-term abortion capital of the country? We have abortion through all 9 months.
Late-term abortion capital of the country is a term being thrown around a lot amongst these pro-life activists. It's referring to the fact that Albuquerque is home to one of only 4 clinics in the nation that openly performs such procedures, and that New Mexico has fewer restrictions on abortions than many other states. Albuquerque's Project Defending Life is one of the groups sponsoring the legislation. According to spokeswoman Tara Shaver, they collected over 27,000 signatures, more than double the number required by city law for an initiative to get a spot on the ballot.
We always have a hard time at the legislative level, so we thought, well, let's see what we can do in the city. And it's really fitting since we do have a late-term abortion clinic.
Shaver adds that while she'd like to see abortion banned altogether in New Mexico, this is a good start.
You know, we're going to take what we can get, and this bill is very strong, and it does resonate with the hearts of the American people.
Well, not all the American people.
This is really a way to erode at women's access to abortion overall. And this is a tactic that folks are taking to try and really chip away at that.
In response to the ballot initiative, multiple women's rights groups have joined forces, creating a counter campaign called Respect ABQ Women. Adrian Barboa is with Strong Families New Mexico, one of the effort's partner organizations.
We have gathered as community and family and women and friends to really show that we stand with New Mexican women and that we're going to respect Albuquerque's women's choices.
She says in the weeks leading up to the election, volunteers will be campaigning heavily around the city, phone banking, door knocking, and hosting a series of safe conversations to make sure voters have the information they need before heading to the polls.
We're going to use this as an opportunity to really have these conversations with our communities about the importance of keeping safe and legal abortions for the health and safety of women.
Barboa adds that the ultimate goal is to make sure the ordinance doesn't pass. And if it does, organizations like the ACLU are promising that it will be challenged in court immediately, arguing that it's unconstitutional. UNM political science professor Lana Atkison says it's tough to say which way voters will lean on election day, but she does expect to see both campaigns appealing to voters' emotions.
Emotion is a huge part of politics. When you create emotion with people, you know, you can create fear and anxiety, or you can create anger, and both of those emotions, you know, help to drive people to the polls.
Gone are the days when the federal government will be making large decisions on the issue. According to Atkison, the future of the abortion debate is on the local level.
There's just such gridlock in Washington. I mean, there's not going to be a constitutional, you know, amendment or something like that. I mean, that's not going to happen anytime soon. So, you know, things changing slowly. I mean, sort of like voter ID. You know, this is a state-by-state issue. This is a locality. This is a community issue.
But no matter what voters decide in November, the results will likely not settle the debate here in Albuquerque. As activists on both sides of the issue say, finding common ground is almost impossible. For Making Contact, I'm Carrie Young in Albuquerque.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Because of support from listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Keeping abortion legal could be a moot point if it's impossible to find a doctor to perform one. It's estimated that close to 90% of U.S. counties have no abortion provider. That has a lot to do with local support and funding, but it also has to do with the number of doctors who are trained in the procedure. Well, there's at least one group trying to make sure there's a steady supply of trained professionals. Dr. Jody Steinhauer is an associate professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive sciences based at the University of California at San Francisco. She also founded Medical Students for Choice. We're going to hear more about what that organization does in just a minute. And Sarp Axel is president of Medical Students for Choice. He's a medical student at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York. Welcome both of you to Making Contact.
Thanks.
Glad to be here.
So let's start off with you, Dr. Steinauer. You started Medical Students for Choice back in 1992 because you saw a problem. So what was that problem, and how have you gone about trying to change medical schools?
Well, at that time, I was a first-year medical student at the University of California, San Francisco, and just going about my daily business, focusing on learning anatomy, physiology, basic science. And two events occurred which sort of woke me up, as well as many other medical students around the country. The first was that a mailing was sent out to medical students by an anti-abortion group based in Texas. It was a pamphlet of very offensive cartoons about being an abortionist, and just sort of came out of the blue to us. And that started made us think about, you know, why was this sent to us, and what is our role in abortion care? And we started looking around and realized that while abortion at that time was the most common surgical procedure among reproductive health age women, more common than cesarean section at that time, we were not learning about abortion except only minimally at UCSF. A few weeks after that mailing came, Dr. Gunn, the first abortion provider to be murdered, was killed in Florida. And these two events really made us look at our curriculum and really think about our role in comprehensive reproductive health care, not only in terms of whether we would provide abortions for women, but whether we would be equipped, no matter what specialty we chose, to counsel women, to really be comprehensive in their care and counseling and referral. So we started organizing events at UCSF. We then heard that students elsewhere were having similar events, such as inviting faculty to speak about abortion, having panels of people talk about why they do abortions, and also advocating for integration of abortion into our curriculum.
And so, Sarb, how does that picture of medical schools we just heard jive with your personal experience and that of your peers?
So I was getting my training in surgery on my surgery rotation during third year, and one of my attendings approached me and asked me what I wanted to go into. And when I told him that I planned on pursuing training in obstetrics and gynecology, he scoffed at me and then continued to berate me about my interest in family planning and abortion care, bringing in a lot of discussion about God and the impact that I was going to be having, used words like murder. And this was in the operating room, with nurses listening and other residents listening. So a lot of the challenges that Dr. Steinauer just mentioned actually have not gone away. We still continue to have a substantial lack of routine abortion education in medical schools. A recent survey showed that 17% of schools provide no discussion whatsoever. A Medical Students for Choice survey showed that two-thirds of medical schools provide 30 minutes or less of any kind of abortion discussion, which includes the procedures, the medicine behind it, the ethical issues surrounding it. And students are still stigmatized when they inform faculty that they're interested in ensuring that women have access to comprehensive reproductive health care.
How much training is needed? How much would be appropriate, especially to someone who doesn't plan to be an OBGYN?
Really, all medical students, no matter what specialty they're going to choose, really need to have some basic education about all the common issues that we face in medicine, one of which is abortion, certainly one of which is unintended pregnancy. In terms of quantifying how much time a medical student needs, it might be even sufficient to have, you know, a couple of hours of didactic time and a day in an abortion clinic setting. I think that would actually be adequate. But unfortunately, that's really not available in most medical schools. And even an emergency medicine physician, you know, many women walk into the emergency room or experience some kind of an accident and are brought into an emergency room. And if they're of reproductive age, a urine pregnancy test is sent on them. And so it's even the people in the emergency room who are faced with having to counsel women about their surprise, previously unknown pregnancy.
So who's calling the shots here, both in terms of why is this still happening and what are the levers of change that you're working on? Is it school administrators, teachers? Is it state legislators threatening funding cuts or private organizations threatening funding cuts for abortion training?
It's actually a union of all those factors that you just mentioned. In early 2013, the University of Toledo Medical Center decided to cancel a transfer agreement that it had with these two clinics. And by Ohio law, a clinic that provides abortion services needs to have a transfer agreement with a local hospital in order to remain operational. And so essentially, when the University of Toledo decided to cancel this transfer agreement, it effectively led to the closing of those clinics and the services that they provided. And this obviously has a huge impact on the women of that area, but it also has a huge impact on the medical students and the residents who were depending on those clinics for this abortion training. So now there are 700 medical students in that area who do not have access to routine abortion training. And however many OBGYN, family medicine residents who also rely on the University of Toledo for their training do not have this opportunity. I know that there are some schools whose boards of supervisors or boards of directors have handed down a mandate saying that there will be no discussion of abortion outside of the classroom, certainly no discussion of abortion within the classroom. Some of these institutions, because they're fearful of the financial repercussions, are really not providing those opportunities to their students.
And it's hard to talk about abortion without raising kind of the moral and ethical issue. I think some of our listeners might say, well, doctors should be able to opt out of this if they morally disagree with it, or maybe even the institution. Is there a line between opting out of performing abortions versus learning about abortions?
I mean, I think that's a very great question, but I would argue that it's just good medical care to be able to at least know and speak knowledgeably about a safe and legal medical procedure. I think that's something that all medical students should at least be exposed to. There are a lot of procedures that medical students are taught and expected to memorize facts about that we ultimately do not end up using. But that doesn't mean that it's not important for a physician to know, how to perform an appendectomy or the steps that are involved and the counseling bits that are necessary when you're speaking to a patient who comes in with right lower quadrant abdominal pain. So I think it's a valid point, but it's very important to recognize that abortion is being specifically selected and isolated. And I think that that's a disservice to patients when we remove this procedure from mainstream medicine.
Dr. Jody Steinauer is founder of Medical Students for Choice, and Sarp Axel is president of that organization. Thanks so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to the Media Consortium. Their grant from the Quixote Foundation allowed us to participate with 10 media outlets in the Reproductive Justice Pilot Project. Also, thanks to the Association of Alternative News Media. For more video, radio, and print stories about reproductive health, log on to our website, radioproject.org. That's also where you can get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. The Making Contact team includes Lisa Rudman, George Lavender, Nancy Lopez, Irene Flores, Bonsi Mehta, Dan Turner, and Barbara Barnett. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.